KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. Candy by the cash register, 24-hour drive-thrus, constant food advertising. All of these have contributed to America's obesity epidemic. More than one-third of Americans are obese, and natural scientist Deborah Cohen has some new ideas for solving this problem. Cohen's new book is called A Big Fat Crisis: The Hidden Influences Behind the Obesity Epidemic and How We Can End It. In the book, she argues in favor of government regulation of unhealthy foods and stricter restaurant guidelines. She spoke at Town Hall on January 22, 2014.
Well, thank you all for coming. As you know, my book is called A Big Fat Crisis, and I'm going to talk about how we can end the obesity epidemic. Well, first of all, you all know this, that obesity is bad for health. 2 out of 3 adults and 1 out of 3 children now are overweight or obese, and that's more than 150 million Americans. We know obesity is an underlying cause of heart disease, high blood pressure, type 2 diabetes, cancer, and premature death. And it's costing our healthcare system more than in excess of $150 billion a year. Well, what is the current conversation about obesity? Generally, people think that obesity is an individual choice. They think it is a sign of moral failure or a lack of personal responsibility. And many people believe that if we used willpower, then everyone would have the capacity to control their weight. So what I'm going to tell you tonight is that these assumptions are wrong. And not only that, they're focusing on the wrong target. Because as long as we think that obesity is a matter, is just an individual problem, things will never change. So let's change the conversation. Obesity is a public health crisis. And the root cause of this is that the food industry has turned our nation into a food swamp. The food industry is making billions by encouraging people to overeat. And they're going to lose billions if people stop overeating. Well, how much control do people really have over how much they eat? Well, really, eating is an automatic behavior, and the desire to eat can be triggered by food and food messages, even if we are full. And most people lack the capacity to really assess food quantity by volume just by looking. And so really, when people have a limited capacity to control how much they're eating when too much food is available. And not only that, our ability to make wise choices is limited. You've heard the expression, right? They're only human. So we all have a tendency to make mistakes. It's really been looked at in many different scientific fields. So the behavioral economists call our limitations bounded rationality. The psychologists have called it a limited cognitive capacity. Neurophysiologists call it low executive capacity. And there's another group of psychologists that, you know, just talk about automatic behaviors that people can do things without even thinking. So, you know, all of these fields of science, you know, have a general consensus on how people think. And we really have 2 ways of processing information. Well, first of all, you know, there's so much information and stimuli all around us that whenever we are viewing the world, we only can selectively see parts of it. We don't really see everything. These 2 systems we have, one is called cognitive processing, the other one is called non-cognitive processing. So cognitive processing implies that we're being thoughtful, we're very much aware, we're analyzing a situation, everything is very carefully directed by our brains. But the other kind of processing, non-cognitive processing, really implies a lack of awareness, some automaticity, and really something that's happening without our full control. So cognitive awareness, or this cognitive processing system, is really not necessary for us to choose food. You know, we can be influenced by things that are around us that we won't be aware of. You know, even images that are subliminal, images we don't notice consciously, they can actually affect our choices. When we are in places like restaurants or, you know, the supermarket, we tend to make our choices very quickly in less than a second. And our decisions when we're choosing foods that are, you know, vice foods, you know, cookies, candies, and so on, we actually can make those choices more quickly than when we're choosing things that are good for us, like fruits and vegetables. And, you know, I have the book title here, Thinking Fast and Slow by Daniel Kahneman. His book completely discusses this issue of these two different processing systems, and I do recommend that. So, for example, here's a study that really quantified how quickly people make decisions. And they got a group of volunteers, and they had them look at a computer screen. They first looked at a dot on the screen, and then it went to blank. And then it showed two different snacks. And they were supposed to choose which one they liked better. And then, you know, the screen went blank. So that those images were only shown for 20 milliseconds. And before they did the experiment, they ranked all of the candy that they were going to see on what they liked the best, you know, from 1 to 50. And so they had to quickly, you know, press a button, right or left, which is the one that they ranked higher. And they were able to do this in less than 1/3 of a second. That's how quickly we can look at something, recognize it, and choose it. So if we're doing things that quickly, we're really not thinking a lot about it, right? We're not making a careful, deliberative choice. Okay, so the other thing that we know from behavioral economics, that our decisions are really not necessarily from within us and set. They're easily influenced by the context in which that information is presented. So again, another book that talks about how we're easily influenced by context is called Nudge. Basically, our decision errors are very much widespread and predictable. Our processing is not rational, and it's influenced by things like order. You know, if we hear whatever we hear first or last might be more prominent, and that could influence us more. Comparisons, if we compare something to something more expensive or less expensive, that could influence our choice, and also whether it's presented as a loss or a gain. So, you know, this idea that everything is inside of us and we're in full control is really not the case. The other thing is that we cannot ignore what's around us. You know, when you think about how we interact with the world, we interact through our senses, you know, our hearing, our sight, our taste, our touch, smell, right? Five senses. And those senses are operating all the time. They are operating without our full control. So, you know, we see something moving or flashing, we turn and look at it. We hear something, again, that guides our action. We turn toward that. We smell something, you know, we don't start telling our nose, okay, now nose, smell. You know, it's the other way around. Our nose is always smelling, you know, and they alert us. It alerts us to opportunities or things in our environment. And so what happens is that the neurons that are operating our senses, they're connected in our brain directly to our motor neurons. So we get a stimulus, we perceive it, and then we can act on it immediately. And only after that stimulus goes to our muscles and we start acting on it, then we become aware of it. So it's the opposite of what we think. We tend to think we think of something first and then we do it, but actually we do something or perceive something first and then we become aware of it. Okay, so the causation is the opposite of what most people generally assume. And there's about a half a second gap between when we start to act on something and then we realize that we're acting on it. And probably you can think of instances in your own experience, like, you know, you're driving the car and something's coming and you step on the brake. And then you realize, you know, that happened. It wasn't that you had to wait to realize it and then step on the brake, right? We can act very quickly. And that is something that evolved to protect us, you know, from prey. We can run away. We don't have to sit and think about, well, is that a danger, you know, or, you know, we can move quickly. Okay, so most of our behaviors are actually automatic. So What do I mean by automatic? It's something that doesn't require our conscious direction. So it implies there's a lack of awareness, a lack of intent, a lack of effort, and a lack of control, meaning the inability to stop if we choose. So an automatic behavior doesn't have to be automatic all the time. And whether it's automatic or not depends, again, on the context. So, for example, I started out by saying eating is automatic. Well, what I mean is that we can eat without paying attention. You know, if we have a bowl of popcorn, we can put our fingers in and put the popcorn in our mouth and chew and swallow, and we don't have to consciously direct our hands, you know, to pick up the popcorn. We can do it without looking, without thinking. We can watch TV, and we won't even realize we finished a whole bowl of popcorn until it's all gone. So, you know, that's one of the problems we have with eating, but we're wired to do that. And if we try to do something different, that means we're not going to pay attention to, okay, the TV, maybe that's no loss, but, you know, to our dinner companions. You know, we won't be watching our children. We won't be alert to, you know, some stranger coming by. I mean, this is an advantage, you know, that we can eat automatically, but when there's too much food, then it becomes a problem, okay? So the other problem we have, our limits, is that people have a limited cognitive capacity. So we can only think about one thing at a time. And while we're concentrating that one thing, everything else we can do automatically. So we can multitask, but we really are only focusing on one thing. So this part of our brain that does our conscious processing is actually teeny tiny compared to the rest of our brain that does all of the automatic stuff. And really, when you think about, well, how much of our brain is really thoughtful, we're using that less than 5% of the time. And 95% of the time, we're on this automatic mode, you know, this non-cognitive mode. And if you compare the capacity of the cognitive to the non-cognitive, we process 40 to 60 bits per second. That's like, you know, a couple of sentences. You know, we can only do that. But our entire processing capacity, you know, include all of our senses and our vision, that's more like 11 million bits per second. That's a huge difference. And that's why most of our actions are actually not consciously directive and they're automatic. And just to give you a better idea of what's the relative difference between our ability to be thoughtful and automatic. So if you look at this grid, so you see it's like a graph paper covering the whole screen. And this grid is our brain if we rolled it out flat. And if you look at the red dot in the middle, which is an eensy-weensy dot, that's the size of our cognitive processing capacity. And the rest of it is the size of our ability to act automatically. So you can see, you know, how actually this is 50 times the size, you know, of our cognitive processing capacity. So we have very serious limits on how much of everything that we do we actually fully consciously control. And just to give you an idea, well, how does it translate into real life? So here was a study that was done to find out what kind of decisions do people make when they're under a cognitive load. So there's something that's taking up our processing capacity. And in this case, they had two groups of people and they randomized them so that one group was asked to memorize a two-digit number and then a second group was asked to memorize a seven-digit number. That's like a telephone number without the area code, right? So they just said, okay, here's your number, memorize it, okay, and then go over here and tell us what kind of snack you want when the experiment's over. So, you know, these two groups did it, and let's see, what did they choose? They had a choice of either fruit salad or chocolate cake, okay? And the people who memorized the seven digits, 63% of that group chose chocolate cake. Well, the group that only had to memorize two digits, only 41% chose chocolate cake. That's a 50% difference. So why did the group who had to memorize seven digits, why were they more likely to choose chocolate cake? Well, you know, what the author said of this study is that they had more of their cognitive capacity occupied memorizing the numbers, and they had less available to make a wise or more thoughtful decision. You know, just memorizing a seven-digit number changed someone's preference. Isn't it unbelievable? Something so small as that affects what we choose. So so you can see why, you know, our choices can vary across the day depending on, you know, whether we're preoccupied, distracted, you know, what's available for us to make good choices. It's different.
Deborah Cohen, the author of A Big Fat Crisis, The Hidden Influences Behind the Obesity Epidemic and How We Can End It. She spoke at Town Hall on January 22nd, 2014. You can learn more and hear the whole hour of her talk by going to kuow.org/speakersforum. You can also follow us on Twitter at @KUOWSpeakers. Posey Gruner recorded this talk. I'm Rachel Solomon, KUOW 94.9 Seattle. From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. More than 150 million Americans are overweight or obese. Globally, those numbers are estimated at 1.5 billion. Obesity is one of the top public health crises of the 21st century, and natural scientist Deborah Cohen has some ideas on how to combat it. Cohen's new book is called A Big Fat Crisis: The Hidden Influences Behind the Obesity Epidemic and How We Can End It. She spoke at Town Hall on January 22, 2014. Next, she talks more about how we subconsciously make decisions about what to eat.
Okay, so because this non-cognitive processing is so dominant, you know, we still want to know, well, how does it work? What does it decide? You know, what information does it use to make the choices? Well, it turns out that we use something called heuristics, which are shortcuts. They're simple, efficient rules that are somehow wired by evolution that explain, you know, how we make these automatic choices. And when it comes to food, things with sugar and fat tend to dominate. So that's why we chose chocolate cake, right, when we're preoccupied. But the other things that influence us, like brand names, we get, you know, familiar with a logo or an icon, prices, something cheaper or something more expensive, depending on, you know, whether we're thinking we're rich or poor, right? That might influence us. Whether it's salient and prominent in the environment, or we see what other people do and we automatically mimic them. The appearance, the color, the size, the shape, all of these superficial characteristics really determine what our choices are. And again, whether we use this non-cognitive processing system depends on the context and what else is going on and whether we're overwhelmed or not. Okay, so our dietary decisions, they tend to be automatic and heuristically guided. And that's because we have to eat a lot, you know. I mean, we typically eat at least three times a day, but today Americans are eating like 5 to 6 times a day. You know, and there's so many choices and we're so overwhelmed. You know, there are studies that really look and see, you know, how quickly people make decisions, how thoughtful they are. And it turns out when people go to the supermarket, they're only reading about 10 lines of text per trip. And they communicate, they understand, they perceive the environment mostly through images, icons, packaging, and the location of foods. In restaurants, the same thing. People scan the menus, you know, if they're busy. They might choose something that's more salient, something with a picture, something in bold, something in a box. And so the design of the menus, designs of the stores, designs of the supermarket, they all influence our choices. Okay, so this non-cognitive processing also plays a huge role in how we perceive advertising. So as I mentioned earlier, we don't fully control our senses, and especially our eye gaze. You know, when we go to a place, our eyes are scanning, you know, they're jumping all around and seeing what's available, and they alert us where we should focus our attention. And so the characteristics of our environment really determine what we pay attention to. Now, That isn't to say that that's the sole thing that matters. You know, we also have our own goals, you know, and desires and background and so on. And so that plays a role too, as far as what we will pay attention to. But when you try and divide it up, what's more important, you know, or how does it really work? For the most part, the environment contributes 2/3 to what we pay attention to, while our own individual goals and characteristics, they only contribute 1/3. So you can see why the environment is so important, and it can dominate what our choices are. So we learn a lot about how we perceive the environment through eye tracking studies, and these are used very extensively by advertisers and the food industry, manufacturers, to figure out how they can get our attention. And what they find out is that the longer you look at an ad or a display, the more likely you are to buy that. And so they learned that if they can manipulate the design and change things around, they can potentially get more of your attention, and of course, that's how they're going to increase their sales. And so they found out that pictures do a much better job at getting our attention than numbers. Text size matters. They can, you know, manipulate the fonts. A larger font will get our attention more than a smaller font. And they also find out that when people are under time pressure, they skip the text and they just pay attention to the pictures. So what's really, disappointing or whatever, there's really no rational way to explain what we pay attention to or not. And that what the advertisers do is they just try all the combinations until they pick the one that works the best. So here's an example of an ad. The top one shows a woman leaning to the right, and the text is to the left. And they have people wear these eyeglasses that tell the scientist where the person is looking, because if you ask someone what they're looking at, they won't be able to tell you. They won't know, because, you know, what we perceive is really only a conglomeration of all the places that our eyes are focusing on. So you can see these maps, like where the fingerprints are and the dots are, that's where eyes are moving around and looking at. And so they take different metrics, and they can see, well, you know, how long you're focusing on the different elements of the picture and how well that predicts your attention and your focusing and, you know, your likelihood of buying it. And here, you know, the woman leaning to the right, and they have the text to the left, and they have the product on the bottom, on the left. They found that that actually did not have a good score, you know, all the things that they look at it that show that someone's paying attention. So they moved things around, and they found that the one on the bottom, where they had the woman leading to the left and the text to the right and the product on the right side of the bottom corner, that was 50% better. Yeah, I mean, who would know, right? You have to do these tests to figure out how to organize your page so that you get the most attention. And that's how they get us. You know, we are really vulnerable. I mean, that's how we work. We don't control our senses and what we pay attention to. And the other thing is, food advertising is different from other advertising. How many of you are staring at the desk? Anybody? We, you know, when we have images, food or something else, we preferentially look at the food. You know, we are wired to be interested in food because it's absolutely critical for survival. So we orient to food, and it's actually very problematic for dieters. You know, people who are on a diet, they want to ignore food. They don't want to see food. And, you know, there's something called the ironic process of mental control. So if we're trying to ignore it, we're actually more sensitive to it. It's like, don't think of a polar bear, and that's all you can think of. So that's really difficult for dieters. Okay, so the other thing we know is that when we see food, it makes us hungry. You know, even if we've already eaten, you know, we can still desire food, and we probably can find room for it, especially if it's dessert, right? And when we see tempting food, our brain secretes a neurohormone called dopamine. It's not just food. It's, you know, anything novel or different, something that gets us excited. And this dopamine is a powerful motivator, and it creates the desire for us to obtain the food and eat. It gets us into action. And it uses a pathway in the brain that is the same pathway that's used when we're addicted to drugs, you know, or alcohol or tobacco. We get pleasure from food, you know, especially these tempting foods with a lot of sugar and fat. And, you know, we need to enjoy food, because if we didn't like to eat, we wouldn't survive. You know, it's absolutely necessary to eat. So there are all these reasons why having too much food is a problem for us. So one of the big problems and underlies the obesity epidemic is the portion sizes that are now available in the United States. They are one of the single most important determinants of how much we eat, because when you serve people more than they need, they will eat more than they should. And there have been so many experiments about this. They've been repeated with, you know, people who are thin, people who are overweight, people who are neurotic, people who are, you know, teens and children and all kinds of people. Everyone generally will eat more than they need if they're served too much. So here's one study where they did this with children. And I'm coming to that one next. So generally people eat more, and sizes have gotten larger. Okay, so here's the study with the children where they doubled their entree at lunch and kids ate 25% more. And, you know, they actually looked to see, you know, what was the mechanism? Were they just taking more bites? Were they chewing more? And they actually took the same number of bites, but they put more on their spoons and they opened their mouths wider to take in more food. It's unbelievable. And kids are absolutely not aware of it, just as none of us are aware of it, because we don't pay attention. We're doing something else usually when we're eating. And it's just too impossible to know. It's such an automatic behavior. And when we eat too much, we typically don't compensate. Here, the kids did not compensate by eating less of other foods on their tray. And, you know, if they were asked, "You see anything different about the food today?" they didn't realize that they were served more. And that's a very consistent finding in these studies. People can't tell the difference when they're served too much. So lots of studies again. How can the food industry sell more food? The 70s is when they started understanding how these in-store factors influence what we buy and, of course, then how much we eat. But here they wanted to see, could they increase the sales of fruits and vegetables? And they just doubled the display space. And they found if they just had more of it on display, they could increase hard fruit sales by 44%, soft fruit by 49%, cooking vegetables almost 60%, right? Just doubling the shelf space. So this was a very important lesson for the food industry. And they applied it to what? To junk food. Why do you think we have aisles just for potato chips or soda or cookies? Why do we need a whole aisle? Because it increases how much we buy of it. Why are stores getting larger? So we can have more shelf space. And the other thing that we need a lot of are these end aisle displays. Because if you put food in these locations, they sell 2 to 5 times more than placing the same food like in the middle of the aisle or on the bottom shelf. There's something about the display that automatically attracts our attention, makes us look more, it's convenient, we reach for the food there. And what's on the end aisle displays? Nowadays, it's typically chips, soda, cookies, it's junk food. And you know why? Because manufacturers are paying the supermarkets for that particular space. And the supermarkets tend to make more money from selling shelf space than they do from selling the goods to customers. And all of that, you know, I mean, if they put junk food on the end aisle display, we're going to eat more junk food. You know, we think we're responsible. If you go to the store, you buy something there, you say, "Why did you buy it?" People will blame themselves. They'll say, "Well, I didn't have control." But the fact is, it was the location that influenced what they buy. But people are absolutely not aware of these kinds of factors. So we are influenced below our conscious awareness in many ways, not just by the positioning or the shelf space. In fact, just playing music can influence what we eat or how much we eat of it. And here's a study where they took a restaurant and they changed the music. So some days they played pop music, some days they played classical music, some days they had no music. And they found that when they played classical music, people spent more money, they ordered more appetizers and coffee, and there was a trend to order more desserts. So why is that? You know, they speculated, said, well, maybe people think, you know, classical music is high class and it's related to wealth and leisure, right? So they ordered the extras. I mean, these are things that occur, again, in this automatic, non-cognitive part of our brain that we don't really fully control, you know. You can't ask someone, why did you order the dessert? They can't say, well, it was because I heard classical music. You know, people won't make that connection. This is something in psychology they call priming, okay? So another example of priming, you know, if we watch TV, you know, there's a lot of food commercials on TV. Well, they did an experiment where they showed a group of kids a TV show with a lot of junk food commercials, and they did the same show but with non-food commercials. And they gave the kids a bowl of Goldfish crackers to eat while they're watching TV. When they had the food commercials, the kids ate 45% more Goldfish crackers than when they had the non-food commercials. So it's just, you know, we don't even realize we can be influenced to eat when, you know, for things that we won't have any idea. So our personal behaviors depend on local conditions. You know, these external environmental factors have considerable control over what and how much most people eat. And as I said, most people lack insight into the source of our eating behaviors.
Deborah Cohen, the author of A Big Fat Crisis, The Hidden Influences Behind the Obesity Epidemic and How We Can End It. She spoke at Town Hall on January 22, 2014. You can learn more and hear the whole hour of her talk by going to kuow.org/speakersforum. You can also follow us on Twitter at kuowspeakers. Posey Gruner recorded this talk. I'm Rachel Solomon, KUOW 94.9 Seattle. From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. Deborah Cohen is a natural scientist and the author of A Big Fat Crisis, The Hidden Influences Behind the Obesity Epidemic and How We Can End It. In the book, she argues in favor of government regulation of unhealthy foods and stricter restaurant guidelines. She spoke at Town Hall on January 22, 2014.
So I conclude from all of this research that we need help. And I think it's time for the government to step in to protect us from all of these forces that lead us to eat too much when we don't need to eat that. The government's role really is to protect people against risks that they cannot defend themselves against. You know, government already has the mission. They protect us from food that'll make us sick, you know, like if it's adulterated or contaminated. They already do that. They protect us from defective consumer products and also from misleading and false advertising. So what I think is called for is changing the food environment, especially at the point of purchase. So, for example, in restaurants, I think we need standardized portion sizes so that we're not automatically served more food than we need, and we have a way to gauge exactly what we're getting. We need standards for food quality so that we reduce the risk of chronic diseases. And in supermarkets and other retail outlets, we really have to do something about this impulse marketing, especially that marketing of the foods that increase our risk of chronic diseases, you know, like, let's get rid of candy at the cash register. I'm not saying ban candy, but don't throw it in our faces wherever we go. All right, so let's talk about standardized portion sizes. So again, that's really to help people gauge what they're eating. So we already have standards for portions. The USDA has a set of standards, and the FDA has something called the RAC, the Reference Amounts Customarily Consumed. And those were created in 1981, which is before we started this new acceleration in obesity. And basically what it does is just says, okay, what's the volume or the weight of foods that people will typically consume in one serving? And so, for example, a portion of macaroni and cheese would be 1 cup, a slice of pizza would be 5 ounces. And it really, it's not going to be rocket science. It would just require that when we go out and we serve food, that we can get a single portion when we want. Because otherwise we don't know what we're getting and we can't tell by looking. The other thing we should do is improve the quality of away-from-home food. Right now, if we go out to eat, most of the time we will be increasing our risk of a chronic disease or exacerbating one that we already have. Because a study showed that 96% of entrees, you know, from the main chain restaurants do not meet the USDA guidelines for balanced meals. They have too many calories, too much fat, sugar, and salt, and too few fruits, vegetables, and whole grains. And if we routinely fail to eat a balanced diet, the excesses and the nutrient insufficiencies accumulate over time, and that's the cause of chronic diseases. That's why we get heart disease or type 2 diabetes. And what's interesting to me about this, the relative risk of getting these negative outcomes are very common, and they are much higher than the risks we have, you know, of things that we already control. Like, for example, in many places, we don't allow smoking, right, in public places. Well, the risk of getting cancer from secondhand smoke is about the same as the risk of getting colon cancer from eating meat every day. I mean, we regulate the tobacco smoke, but we don't have any warnings, right, on meat or processed foods, you know, that's going to increase our risk of cancer. I mean, really, if we were going to somehow make some equivalency, we should have every, you know, sort of deli display case in a supermarket called Cancer Alley, right? So I don't know when we'll get there. Anyway, at restaurants, I really think every restaurant should have at least one meal that won't increase our risk of a chronic disease. Don't you? Don't you think that, you know, and then what would a meal have to be? It would have to have fruits, vegetables, right, whole grains, and be basically a third of what our daily requirements are. We have some standards. A group of experts came up with some nutritional standards, and there's an appendix where it has those in the book, and it's online on the RAND website. What about supermarkets? You know, as I mentioned, we should prohibit the sale of these low nutrient items at the cash register near the front entrance and the end aisle and the special floor displays. Because, you know, if we're trying to resist this impulse marketing, it uses up this cognitive capacity we have, which is very limited. And if we spend all of our time fighting the food environment, that means we have less energy and capacity to do the things that we really want to do. And so it really, the food environment now is forcing us all to become dieters to an extent. It's just not right. It's like, it doesn't seem fair, you know, that I have to waste all this time and energy when I have other things I would rather be doing. Okay. All right, so you might say, what is she saying? We need a nanny government? And you know what? Yes, I am saying we need a nanny, because why? Nannies care about us. You know, they really are there to make sure we stay in good health. And, you know, we think about the perfect nanny, Mary Poppins. You know, if you remember, she was an advocate of portion control. You know, she recommended 1 spoonful of sugar, right? Where you have the food industry, the beverage industry, they would have us drink 20-ounce sodas with 16 spoons of sugar. Well, who's the better nanny? Okay, so really, what is a nanny? A nanny government? A nanny government is a government that has standards and regulations. I mean, we really depend on standards and regulations for all of the things that have made us healthier as a country. So if we didn't have standards and regulations, we wouldn't have clean water. Our air would be more polluted. cars wouldn't be safe, our houses wouldn't be sturdy, our working conditions wouldn't be safe. I mean, this is, standards and regulations are the backbone of public health. And we don't have any when it comes to the food environment for the prevention of chronic diseases. Yeah, we check restaurants and supermarkets for infectious diseases, but we don't do anything about the non-infectious diseases. And it's because we have those standards that foodborne disease is really hardly a significant occurrence. You know, it used to be in the top 10 causes of morbidity and mortality at the beginning of the 1900s, and now it's not even, you know, in the top 20. And its standards and regulations are the reason why we've made that advance. So I want to just talk to you a little bit about a model that I think has worked really well for alcohol. We started out in the 18th century with no standards or regulations for controlling alcohol. In fact, alcohol was the beverage of choice in colonial America, and America was known as a nation of drunkards because at that time they believed that water was for animals and alcohol was the only thing that, you know, was fit for humans. So it was served all the time. You know, there's also wasn't very secure that they could find water that was safe to drink, but they served alcohol to children. You know, it was Applejack. They gave it out in political campaigns. The tavern was the social institution of the community. And the consumption of alcohol in 1830 was three times what it is today. That's per capita, per every child, you know, man and woman. And here's a graph of our alcohol consumption. This is from that book, The Alcoholic Republic, by William Mirabeau. And you can see in 1830, the peak of alcohol consumption was over 3 gallons per capita. This is pure alcohol. And surprise, surprise, within a 10-year period, it declined to one-third of what it was. That was a very sharp drop. You can see, you know, declined a little bit further when they had prohibition, but the main impact was between 1830 and 1840. So why was that? Well, the temperance movement started, and they said, well, a lot of people recognized that alcohol was a problem, and they said, you know, they didn't blame people. They said the problem was demon rum, and people were the victims. And so they acted to limit the accessibility of alcohol. And so what they did is they said, okay, we can't sell it to children anymore. We don't want drinking on the job. You know, before, employers would pay their workers alcohol as in lieu of wages. So they had incentives for workplaces not to have alcohol. They gave lower insurance rates. And they even had people that would subsidize a tavern if they wouldn't sell alcohol. So if the owner said, well, if I don't sell drinks, I'll lose money, I'll go out of business. And they said, well, you just let us know what the difference is and we'll pay you that as long as you don't serve alcohol. And so gradually there was a demand for those places and they didn't have to keep subsidizing them. But it was really through the restriction of alcohol accessibility that it was controlled. And so we've gone the whole gamut, you know, with alcohol policies, but the ones that survive are the reasons why alcohol-related morbidity and mortality are declining in the U.S., you know, at the same time that obesity rates are skyrocketing. So what do we have? We license alcohol outlets. We limit the density of alcohol outlets. We limit their hours of operation. Many places prohibit specials. You can't get two drinks for the price of one. They don't have all you can drink. We have portion control. If we get a drink, we can expect a beer is going to be 12 ounces, wine is 5 ounces, a shot of liquor 1.5 ounces, and that's because they all have 0.6 ounces of ethanol. So we can then gauge how drunk we might become by the number of drinks we have, right? So this is a help for us. It doesn't limit how much we can order, but it lets us, you know, control ourselves a little better. We have alcohol taxes. In many places, most places, we ban drive-up sales, you know, of alcohol. They still have them in New Orleans. You can get a drive-up daiquiri, and of course, they have the highest rates of alcohol-related morbidity and mortality there. We have controls on displays. In California, you're not allowed to sell alcohol within 5 feet of the cash register or near the front door in a gas station. We limit the sales of alcohol by age. We don't have alcohol in vending machines, right? So we have a huge number of policies that regulate alcohol, and I think this is the model that we really need to end obesity. So some people might say, well, you know, we were able to do that over time. You know, alcohol is clearly, people get drunk, they hurt other people. It's not just them hurting themselves. But we've done a lot of things. We've made very dramatic changes in other areas. And I think it's still possible today. I mean, I know some people might think my suggestions are a little wild and people aren't going to jump right up and down and start implementing these things. But, you know, think of what a big change the Americans with Disabilities Act was in 1990. You know, before that time, we didn't really see too many disabled people because they were shut in. They, you know, didn't have a way to get around. Places, you know, couldn't accommodate them. Their wheelchairs couldn't go up the curbs. But with this, they targeted the environment. They said there's no reason why disabled people can't be like everybody else and be mainstreamed and part of society. And they mandated that every single place have access. And that cost a lot of money. You know, restaurants had to redo their bathrooms to accommodate wheelchairs. You know, we had to put up ramps to all these places. And, you know, the things I'm recommending isn't going to cost anything. I mean, how much does a measuring cup and a kitchen scale cost, right? And we're not talking about big capital improvements, you know, to regulate food. And so, you know, if we can make changes, you know, for people who are disabled, for sure we can make changes for the majority of people who are suffering from overweight and obesity. Of course we can. So it always comes back to, you know, people say, okay, yes, I see your point, but why can't people just have more self-control, right? That's the end. They think they gotcha. Everyone should take care of it themselves. But, you know, I want to remind you, self-control is limited. It fatigues like a muscle. And our capacity for self-control appears to be genetic. And so if you are born with the genes, you know, of someone with low self-control, you'll probably never be able to increase it as much as, you know, you might need to, especially in an environment where there's food everywhere. And, you know, you might be familiar with the studies where they were testing self-control among four-year-olds, and they put them in a room and with a marshmallow, and they said, okay, here's a marshmallow. You can eat it if you want, but if you can wait 3 minutes and not eat it, I will come back and I will give you another marshmallow. You can have two marshmallows. And they tested all these people, all these children, and, you know, about 35% of them failed, that they couldn't wait, you know, for the marshmallow and they were eating it. But they followed these children up over time, and they actually recently tested them 40 years later, right, age 44. And they found that the people who, as children, couldn't resist the marshmallow, they had lower self-control skills than their peers, you know, 40 years later who could. So, you know, we can't just say, oh, everybody can increase their self-control. They can't. You know, there's a variation. Some people are limited. Most of us are average. Some are below, some are above. We have to really make the environment fit for the whole population. So, in conclusion, we underestimate the influence of too much readily available low-nutrient food. If people were rational and they had the capacity to control how much they eat, they would. Why not? Who wants to gain weight? Who wants to be, you know, have a chronic disease? You know, we can't change people's automatic responses to the environment, and we can't ignore the environment. And so the future research and the future interventions have to focus on changing the retail food environments and making the easy choice the healthy choice. And our new policies have to account for the limits of human capacity. So in conclusion, that's, you know, my book has all of this information and more. I hope you'll read it. And even if you don't, or if you do, I hope that you will join some kind of group so that to help us drain the food swamp, you know, and really end all of the forces that are behind the obesity epidemic. Thank you very much.
Deborah Cohen, the author of A Big Fat Crisis, The Hidden Influences Behind the Obesity Epidemic and How We Can End It. She spoke at Town Hall on January 22, 2014. You can learn more and hear the whole hour of her talk by going to kuow.org/speakersforum. You can also follow us on Twitter at @KUOWSpeakers. Posey Gruner recorded this talk. I'm Rachel Solomon, KUOW 94.9, Seattle.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.